Now let's get on with the show. This year we noticed that some of the more popular shows we have had have been on China, and it was time to revisit that, and maybe just from a little bit different angle than we had before. And I think it becomes more and more apparent that some people like to simplify things as this is this country's century and that's the other country's century. But it looks how the 21st century is fleshing out that it's not going to be an American century per se, but it's also not going to be a Chinese century. But a lot of it is going to be defined about how the U.S. and China and the allies and friends and relationships that they develop, how we move forward together in the Western Pacific and also some of the resource-rich parts of the world that we both have a legitimate and honest national interest in. And part of that equation are those things that are closest to China. And we're going to touch on some of those today. And our guest for the full hour is Mark Stokes. He is Executive Director of the Project 2049 Institute. And as a stepping point for our discussion, I'd invite those to go over to my home blog, where you can find a link to one of their latest thought pieces titled Asian Alliances in the 21st Century. And we're going to use that as kind of a touchstone and a basis for the next hour's conversation. Mark, welcome to MidWraps.
Hey, I appreciate it. Appreciate it. I hope everybody's having a good weekend.
Hey, put the extended background up on my homepage for you, but for right now, over at the Project 2049 Institute, if you could just take a minute and describe for the listeners what the Institute does, what goal is it trying to achieve, and some of the work that it's pushed out recently they might find of interest.
Okay, well, first of all, we're a relatively new nonprofit sort of a research outfit, a think tank in the traditional terminology, and we stood up in January 2008, and sort of carve out somewhat of a unique niche. We tend to focus on Asia in particular, Asia Pacific region. The goal is to try to look out at trends rather than getting into the current politics of the day. But so that the goals don't always do that. But we have different people that focus on different aspects. Our leader, the head of the 2049 Institute, is Randy Shriver, who is formerly with Office of Secretary of Defense on the China Taiwan desk. My former boss, actually, many years ago, and he's now with Armitage, or he's of course closely associated with Armitage, former Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage. And then we have another individual, Russell Xiao, who helps us out on sort of a lot of our research, and then myself. So we have three full-time staff, and then we have some other associates that also conduct some research for us. My particular area focuses primarily on looking at Chinese military modernization, with a particular emphasis on from the space and missile forces, and then of course Taiwan as well. But we try to cover the whole region, but tend to stay somewhat focused on China. Of course, the 2049, the title, again trying to imply trying to look out, not necessarily the year 2049, but trying to look out over the horizon, but also to be able to represent the emergence of China and the influence that it has on the Asia Pacific region, looking out over the next half century.
Well, it's a pretty ambitious project to try and figure out what's going to happen. But let's kind of go back and set the background for what's going on with Taiwan and or what we call the Republic of China. Why is that such a significant part of what the Chinese are involved with, and what's the significance to the United States and to our allies?
Well, of course, there's a historical legacy, and it's not just, of course, Taiwan or the Republic of China, but a lot of it's rooted in competition between the Communist Party of China and the Nationalist Party of China that goes back to, let's say, as far back perhaps as 1911, in a competition, political competition for sort of who has the right to be able to rule all of China. Of course, in the Civil War, after some exhaustive sort of long-term campaign against the Japanese, the Communist Party eventually was able to force the Nationalist Party off of the Chinese mainland and onto Taiwan. And of course, then you also have that enters a new sort of a new part, which is sort of people that have inhabited Taiwan for centuries, that had sort of a new dynamic. But the United States, of course, had supported the Nationalist Party for many years, and in keeping with a One China principle, had recognized the nationalists as being the sort of the inheritors of One China. And it wasn't until pressure by several different factions to be able to shift the recognition within that One China principle from the Republic of China to the People's Republic of China, and that occurred formally in 1979. But since then, it doesn't necessarily mean that the United States would formally sort of abandon Republic of China or Taiwan, and in its place, instead of adopting sort of a two-China formulation, sort of a dual recognition or dual representation policy, in the place in terms of recognizing the People's Republic of China and acknowledging, without necessarily formally agreeing to their position, that they're representative of One China. The United States, in the place of formal recognition, enacted the Taiwan Relations Act in 1979, which states that the United States, for all intents and purposes, would continue to treat Taiwan as a de facto sovereign independent state, but without having a lot of diplomatic trappings. But at the same time, also outlined certain obligations on security to be able, for example, provide Taiwan necessary defense articles and services for sufficient self-defense, as well as maintaining the capacity to respond to the potential for People's Republic of China, an unfortunate decision they can make to use force against Taiwan. So that's the political background that continues until today in terms of United States obligations to provide Taiwan with necessary defense articles and services for sufficient self-defense. And that's sort of the political context. And the key thing to today in terms of our interests in assuring that Taiwan has a solid, viable defense capability, one of the principles, of course, is to be able to deter or discourage Beijing's reliance on military instruments to resolve their political differences with Taiwan. And so the idea is to be able to continue to provide them with necessary weapon systems.
You know, that folds into something that we saw in the news this week. It's, you know, it wasn't invented by Rumsfeld, but anybody that read his recent book, he repeats it over and over about his big takeaway from decades of service in the government is that weakness invites aggression. And many times people make decisions that result in weakness with a hope that it will prevent aggression, but history tells us over and over and over again that just the opposite takes place. And you know, whether we're talking about F-16s or their long effort to try to find some way to get an upgraded conventional submarine capability, we are positioning Taiwan to at least appear weaker and weaker. From the Chinese perspective, is this making it more or less likely that some type of aggression from Taiwan may be a more viable option for them down the road?
Well, this has both a political component and a military component. On the political front, part of the a deal, but an understanding that Beijing may not have liked or appreciated. But part of it was the assumption that after 1979, with a shift in diplomatic recognition, the United States continued to sell arms to Taiwan, something that Beijing doesn't like at all. And in 1982, there was an understanding that was communicated via a joint communique that we would reduce our arms sales quantitatively and qualitatively over time to Taiwan. However, that was contingent upon Beijing providing an environment conducive to doing so, which would mean sort of a peaceful approach. And the way that one demonstrates a peaceful approach is by reducing the military posture that the People's Liberation Army, or PLA, would have opposite Taiwan. And so on the political front, Because Beijing has not reduced its military posture opposite Taiwan, in principle, there should be no hesitation whatsoever to be able to honor a request that that the government of the Republic of China or Taiwan would make for arms sales in terms of what they believe are necessary for their defense. And so, in general, in order to encourage Beijing to be able to reduce the military posture and reduce that reliance upon use, potential use of force or coercive use of force, then certainly that provides a different, you know, the arms sales issue provides a disincentive for Beijing. On the military front, one could argue about what Taiwan's requirements are till midnight. But in general, having a viable ability to be able to defend the skies over Taiwan and the Taiwan Strait is certainly reasonable. Their air force is reducing their they're relying heavily upon this large part of their air force is relying upon older F-5s that are aging, and being able to at a minimum replace the F-5s out with F-16s, particularly for example what's being considered, of course, would be Block 50, seems to be quite reasonable. And Taiwan has done, or their Ministry of National Defense has done detailed studies on what the requirements are, using basically cost and operational effectiveness evaluations on what they need. So the F-16s seem to be reasonable and measured, initiative. And of course, on the naval side, Taiwan has long had a requirement for at least 8 conventional diesel-electric submarines, and this goes back all the way to 1969. This is one particular capability that Beijing seems to find particularly distasteful, whether it's for political reasons or whether it's for true military reasons, presumably because of the complications that having a viable submarine force could cause to Beijing, any attempt by the PLA Navy to be able to blockade Taiwan. But because submarines have a particular political tinge to them, Beijing has gone out of its way to be able to block Taiwan from acquiring these electric submarines. Taiwan's initial request to the United States for assistance in its submarine program goes back to 1994. And then it was finally the Bush administration in 2001 agreed to assist Taiwan in its acquisition of these electric submarines. Didn't necessarily say sell through foreign military sales channels, but that was left open. But that was 2001, and haven't had much progress since that time. 10 years hence.
Well, there's a current bill that's been introduced in the House of Representatives to kind of push an improvement, I guess, or enhancement of the Taiwan Relations Act. And part of that seems to be in response to the fact that President Obama has before him the decision that he says he's going to make fairly soon as to whether or not to go ahead and sell those Block 50 F-16C /D models to the Taiwanese. You want to discuss that a little bit?
Well, I'm not... I'm quite aware about actually potentially 2 pieces of legislation being forwarded, one on the Senate side and a broader one perhaps on the House side. And of course, part of it is to be able to get some traction, to be able to get some relief on the sale through foreign military channels of additional F-16s. Bear in mind what makes this a little bit strange. Bear in mind that the United States already approved F-16s for Taiwan back in 1992. And of course, at the time, those were basically Block 20s, F-16AB midlife upgrades. And Beijing, as expected, reacted negatively to this particular arms sale. It's hard to say exactly what the effects were, but in this particular case, what Taiwan is asking for is an additional 66. F-16s, again, as a replacement for their older F-5s. And there has been, I'm not quite sure the exact reasons, but there has been some delay in coming up with a decision. But it appears that a decision may be forthcoming, but it looks like at least an interim decision is going to be able to retrofit Taiwan's, or at least a portion, if not all, of Taiwan's existing F-16s up to roughly maybe Block 50 capabilities, or maybe even more if they approve the active electronically scanned array radar part of this, or AESA, which actually, if I'm not mistaken, actually takes it above Block 50. So this capability, if it actually does go forward, is significant, but it still doesn't answer Taiwan's legitimate request for additional F-16s.
Going towards the D and dime diplomacy, on page 5 of the Asian Alliances in 21st Century paper that y'all put out, there's a really intriguing line at the bottom, kind of prefaced with discussing balancing in relations with China. And it said that it will take, here's the quote, it will take sophisticated statesmanship that has been absent in American foreign policy for decades, unquote. How are y'all defining that term, sophisticated statesmanship, and what would be a good example of the practice that has been missing for so long?
Well, I have to go back. I don't know how to have it right in front of me, but in general, it's not clear whether or not, and, you know, taking this up to even a sort of at the 100,000 foot level, it's not clear that we really have a strategy per se for dealing with our allies and friends and others in the Asia-Pacific region. And the strategy, I guess one could talk about find a strategy as knowing what we want. In other words, sort of a perfect world. It's not quite clear what we really want, and so it's hard to really develop a strategy if we don't know what we want, and that's an initial point. Our strategy appears to be more process, or our goals appear to be more process-oriented, meaning not necessarily push the region in a particular direction, but whatever problems or disputes that there are in the region, that use of force is not applied or used as an instrument to be able to resolve these disputes. And at this particular time, since many years, since the Cold War, the alliance structure in the region has generally been primarily bilateral in nature, and haven't had a lot of cooperative efforts in our alliances. Some could refer to this sort of a hub and spoke model. But if you look at the trends, and it's not quite clear if this is going to change all that much in terms of trying to get more synergies between the various sort of allied partners and potential ad hoc coalition partners in the region. It's not quite clear that that's going to, you know, how to be able to go back to get to develop more synergies. Of course, the in terms of balancing, there's at least a perception, of course, that China's power is rising, and it's unclear how things are going to turn out in the future in terms of how their power and how they're going to use their power. And so it has been proposed that one way of doing this is to develop a hedge, and one way to hedge for it, of course, would be to develop more synergies that could be developed by more cooperation among allies and friends in the region until we get a better direction for how things with China could evolve. And of course, there's also dangers in this, because when you do have sort of a bandwagon effect, it has the potential, of course, to be able to raise threat perceptions of China and sort of intensify some of their mistrust that others could have in the region. But that's where really what it comes down to is, you know, how to reassure allies and friends in the region that the United States is not sort of moving out of the region or sort of reducing their interest in the region. But at the same time, how does one attempt to be able to reassure China that it's not necessarily trying to contain them per se, or trying to sort of go in on the offensive against the Communist Party of China. But it requires some degree of diplomacy and some more thinking about how to do it.
One of the things I got out of the paper is that China seems to be focused on at least three main areas. One, of course, we've just discussed with the Taiwan issue, but they also are concerned with their northern waters, that area between them and Japan, and say up to the Koreas. And then their South China Sea issues. And I understand part of the, obviously, the point of the paper is to discuss the alliances to help us as an alliance, which I think you're indicating doesn't currently exist, but we need to develop rather quickly to deal with those issues. Can you kind of, am I on the right path with that? And can you kind of describe what the problem is with getting the various alliances together?
Well, first, let me just sort of start off with one of your initial comment. I would say that China's primary concern at this particular point on what they would view as territorial and sovereignty disputes. And that's probably the clearest possible potential flashpoints in the future. And of course, these include the islands, you know, the southern islands off of Japan. The Japanese call them the Tsukakus. You know, the Chinese would call them the Diaoyu Islands. So that would be one potential flashpoint in the future. Of course, Taiwan being primarily a sovereignty issue, that being another potential flashpoint. And the one that's been around for quite a while, but it's gotten into the news a lot more recently over the last year or so due to incidents with the Philippines and Vietnam and others in Southeast Asia, but that's the South China Sea issue. And still some debate about how, you know, is this what the Chinese would call a core interest? Has it been declared clearly as being a Chinese core interest, or what does that really mean, the core interest? But one also shouldn't forget that there are other possible territorial disputes that are still unresolved until today, like, for example, with India, with India. So this is sort of one way to sort of frame the issues is to put things in the context of these territorial and sovereignty disputes. But in terms of why, why Japan, for example, or South Korea, or whether countries in Southeast Asia would not want to do more together, I think a lot of it has to do with the perception of sort of that if there's more bandwagoning, and more cooperation between the alliances around China, that it could be perceived by China as being extra threatening, and from some allied perspectives, something they don't necessarily, they want to be a little more careful of. And so they tend to handle things in sort of particular dispute areas, and in more of a bilateral context than, of course, in a sort of regional-wide context, with the possible exception being Southeast Asia, where you've had some a little bit more sort of discussions within the Southeast Asian context on a regional basis.
The question we brought up a couple of times in the previous episodes we have is, and a lot of it probably has to do with the fact, you know, the young nation versus the old nation, America obviously being the young nation, has to do with a focus on history and less concerned about the trend of the moment, but the proven trends in the past. For instance, a few of the Naval War College professors we've had on board as guests emphasize the fact that it drives them a little batty that the present day people that are studying Mahan the most are Chinese. They're not as interested in the buzzword of the week. They want to, you know, look at what has been, you know, proven as a fact and to work. But even our near term history, we've kind of forgotten about. For instance, y'all brought up a couple of times something that, you know, may have been a passing interest from our perspective, but persists to this day among the Chinese, but also their neighbors. And that was the carrier surge in 1996. Could you flesh out a little bit of that, or why that took place and why that continues to be an ongoing issue with the Chinese and how they look at maritime power and their contested zones, so to speak?
You mentioned it was a carrier surge, were the words that you mentioned?
Yeah, the surge of carriers off Taiwan in 1996.
Okay, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. First of all, bear in mind, I come at this issue a bit more from an Air Force perspective on where sort of a bias on sort of the Asia-Pacific region really being an aerospace theater due to the large spaces and the need for speed to be able to get to point A to point B very, very quickly. And so I'd sort of put that as a preface that there may be some biases on this. But one thing I mentioned, when you mentioned that sort of the Mahanian theory in China, I haven't looked at in detail exactly where sort of those pockets of Mahanya theory are coming from. But when, if you look at, in a similar sense, the United States or other countries, you have bureaucracies within the People's Liberation Army, in which, you know, they're basically for trying to get maximize pieces of the defense budget. And so obviously, the PLA Navy is going to be making a strong argument to be able to get a larger part of that, defense budget. And so it's going to be making cases for, not sure what the term of RB, but sea control, for example, or extending their ability to operate further from the shores all the way out, you know, in, for example, out way out into the Pacific, or perhaps all the way down through the South China Sea and all the way to the Indian Ocean, for example, to be able, for example, to maintain security of sea lines of communication and for escort duty and for, crisis stability and issues like this. But it's not, you know, how this all plays out in terms of what direction that China's really going, it's not clear yet. My view, where a lot of their efforts are going, bear in mind, submarines appear to be a major area of investment within the PLA. But beyond that, the investment that they've been making and the growth that we've seen in their missile force, particularly their conventional missile force, second artillery in particular, is to me one of the most significant trends within the PLA. Of course, this missile force being one that would basically delivering firepower from inside China, for example, around the periphery. Of course, the best example of this being the anti-ship ballistic missile that appears to be nearing completion of its research and development, if not already having a rough design that's already been approved, at least starting to be introduced into experimental units to be able to sort of work out bugs in terms of training and tactics and doctrine and things like this. But so the question is, you know, why was that assigned? Why was that role, when it comes to sea control, or at least sea denial, it seems to be a pretty significant capability, but why was this maintained within the 2nd Artillery and not turned over, for example, to the PLA Navy? That's a question I've had. And but you know, there's some other things to watch in terms of where they're investing, for example, on the nuclear side with their new nuclear submarines. But the thing about ballistic missiles in general is that people look at, for example, the new trend within the 2nd Artillery, and they focus on the anti-ship ballistic missile. But that's not the only sort of progress that that the Chinese are making in their aerospace modernization, because being able to sort of take some of the missile systems that they have right now, being able to deliver firepower accurately, let's say, for example, with a circular error probability of, let's say, rough notionally 30 meters, 50 meters, and be able to take that capability that they have, for example, they deployed that has a 600-kilometer range or 1,000-kilometer range, for example, in a Taiwan scenario, and be able to take that capability that they could array against Taiwan and be able to use that to enforce some of the, China's position, some of their other territorial disputes, for example, with Japan. And as time goes on, perhaps even further, for example, being able to apply some of these capabilities in terms of precision strike all the way out to Guam, for example, or perhaps to other areas in Southeast Asia. And then with that sort of being... we would think of some of these capabilities as in the context of stealth. In other words, be able to attain the upper hand and gain air superiority, you need to be able to suppress air defenses. Ballistic missiles can be viewed in this way. So with the idea being they at least want to be able to go after air defenses or be able to go after air assets, whether they be on the ground or on the ocean. With the idea, again, being that if you can control or at least deny an adversary control of the air, or, then you have much greater freedom of movement on the surface, whether it's land or whether it's ocean. And so the idea, to me, the key emphasis of the key trend seems to be gaining ability both on the ballistic missile side and perhaps in the future on the air side, bearing in mind that if you can knock out runways, then your requirements in terms of fighters go down to a certain extent, because if you can pin down air defenses with his Patriot or other systems with ballistic missiles, and again it reduces some of your requirements for air assets. But this seems to be a particularly significant area that China is moving into. It's sort of more on the air front, with sea denial, I guess what people would call anti-access area denial, being primarily to me driven by the ballistic missile, the air side of things.
Yeah, I thought one of the interesting points that was made in the paper was this is sort of an aside to some of the main conversation, but the importance of the vertical capability of the F-35, that because of the various threats to carriers and air bases, that capability is something we should really be much more concerned about than we seem to be.
Well, that's certainly one way to address some of the runway, some of the air base availability issues. What would be interesting is to go back through history and to be able to, to figure out how did we resolve some of the problems we had in NATO when we had the, for example, in the Cold War when you had the Soviet forces in East Germany and the old Czechoslovakia. How do we manage air base availability issue then? Because some of the problems. Go back that far, and so that's of course that's when the AV-8 Harrier had its start, but certainly being able to reduce reliance upon longer runways is one way to address the issue via very short takeoff and landing airframes, but it's not necessarily the older answer because because theoretically, if you have a conflict, God forbid, if you have a conflict in the Asia-Pacific region, you're going to lose your runways. Odds are you're going to lose your runways fairly early on in the conflict. But it doesn't mean you're going to not have access to those runways throughout the course of the conflict. Because one of the ideas, of course, is to be able to ride it out and then be able to eventually be able to roll back and be able to reintroduce air assets into a region after you're able to suppress the source of those long-range precision strike assets. But that's also one of the reasons why, in terms of a stability issue, why China's reliance on ballistic missiles appear to have some significant destabilization facets to it. Because the most effective and efficient way to be able to defend against ballistic missiles is not necessarily hit them in the air. Of course, that's part of a broader way to look at it in terms of defending against them. But primarily be able to go after the infrastructure on the ground. And that has significant implications in terms of crossing nuclear thresholds and be able to ensure that there's a clear-cut fire break between the two. But in general, this reliance on ballistic missiles would force a potential adversary, whether it's the U.S., whether it's India, whether it's other potential adversaries in the future, to be able to it increases the tendency or the temptation to be able to go after the missile infrastructure on the ground, which has, stability implications. So to me, I mean, that's one of the things to look at is to, for example, the United States and former Soviet Union both completely destroyed all of their ballistic missiles and ground-launched cruise missiles under the INF Treaty that was agreed to in late 1987, and then ultimately destroyed all ground-launched ballistic missiles and land attack cruise missiles with ranges between about, let's say, 500 kilometers and 5,500 kilometers. And so in this vacuum created by the INF Treaty, this also, I'm not sure if it's coincidental, but this is also where China developed what in effect is the most significant ballistic missile and ground-launched cruise missile capability in the world today.
The kind of going back to the, or actually wandering into the aerospace field for a minute here, one of the more interesting stories is you can have a habit is of getting very comfortable with your sense of dominance. A perfect example of that was early in the Vietnam career. You had pilots flying around in blaze orange flight suits until they realized, well, if we go down, it's kind of hard to evade and escape when you're wearing blaze orange. In a similar sense, especially with our experience of the last 10 years, we've become very, very comfortable with our perceived ownership of what is really the ultimate global commons, and that's the electromagnetic spectrum and also space for both communications, and ISR, the whole gambit. And we've seen a lot written in the media about the Chinese going after the cyber commons and their ability to conduct cyber operations and the potential for that down the road. But there is an equally dangerous crutch that we lean on with our reliance on the electromagnetic spectrum and the space access. How serious are the Chinese looking at that, and are we really focused on that vulnerability to the degree that we should be?
The related, but let me focus on the electromagnetic spectrum issue first. It's tough to get your, or at least for me, tough to get my hands around it. But as a general principle, one should expect the PLA to be looking at means of denying the United States access to basically to be able to maintain situational awareness. And having access to communication systems as well as command and control, and using a wide variety of means to be able to disrupt or deceive our sensors and ability to use information. And both on a technological sense and also just on a sort of stratagem sense. On a technological sense, basically, the Chinese have been, and this is nothing new, they've been doing this since at least early 90s, if not even further, but heavy emphasis in the studying, for example, all the sensors that a potential adversary would use, including the United States, whether it's space sensors, for example, remote sensing satellites, electro-optical or synthetic aperture radar, studying the means of how the whole chain works in terms of downlinks and how information is relayed and how it gets to a commander in a usable form, all the way to, for example, to radars, studying radar, U.S. Radars, whether they're missile defense radars, for example, or phased array radars that could be maritime phased array radars, or whether it's land-based phased array radars, and, of course, all the way to tactical data links, for example, whether it's Link 16 or Link 11, studying these issues in extreme detail. And they publish a lot of their analyses. And then from there, also indications of looking seriously at ways to be able to disrupt whether it's sensors or whether it's communication systems. For example, in the area of being able to, having the ability to be able to jam, being able to jam synthetic aperture radar sensors, whether it's satellite-based or airborne-based. Being able to dazzle, for example, electro-optical satellites by using high-powered lasers, or being able to, again, on the uplinks or downlinks, being able to jam these capabilities, or in a worst-case scenario, of course, being able to use kinetic kill vehicles to go after and physically negate some of these sensors. Or, for example, GPS, navigation satellites, being able to jam our navigation satellites. And there appear to be a number of units around China's periphery that have this particular role and mission. And, of course, all the way to Link 16 or joint tactical data links, again, looking at ways to be able to go in and to be able to find ways, whether it's broadband jamming or high power jamming. Of course, that's going to be difficult to do, but still trying to figure out ways that they can go in and be able to interrupt some data links immediately. Or there's also, of course, the possibility to be able to use the old Soviet model of introducing bad information into some of our networks. And the same thing, of course, for communication networks. Most people tend to focus just on the cyber aspects, and of course, that's another area where China's investing heavily. And in general, when it comes to just simply monitoring the electromagnetic and magnetic environment, because that's really the fundamentals of this whole thing, they have a vast, vast bureaucracy organization that, of course, similar to ours, divided up into communications intelligence and then electronic intelligence or electronic reconnaissance, to use their term, that is upwards, for example, the General Staff Department, Third Department, has upwards of about 130,000 if not more, officers and men who are dedicated to be able to monitor communications in the region. And of course, the same on the electronic reconnaissance, where it looks like they've gone at least some experimental platforms, you know, launching to be able to into space, be able to give a space space-based capability. And so on the electromagnetic spectrum front, they appear to be investing heavily and to be able to, at a minimum, to be able to complicate the ability of potential adversaries to be able to sense and communicate in a crisis environment. So that's the first one.
I just had a little bit of a side angle question there, you know, going from a defensive to an offensive mindset, perhaps. Does China have the same level of vulnerability on the electromagnetic spectrum that we do, i.e., do they have more redundant systems, perhaps, more survivable systems, or are they equally vulnerable and reliant as we are?
I would say, and they have some advantages. Let's say, for example, because in general, they're going to be, if they're going to be operating off of their coast, then they'd be operating in similar parameters that we would be, and so we have certain advantages. In other words, the more extended operations that they have, when they'd be forced to use, for example, HF to be able to communicate with, or satellite, for example, I mean, if they actually do expeditionary operations way, way off the shore or in other regions, that, of course, presents significant vulnerabilities, and so that could be exploited. But the advantage they have of conducting operations within, you know, from their own shores, like, for example, with this anti-ship ballistic missile and other capabilities, is that, you know, they have many, many other, they have significant redundancy built in, all the way to fiber optics, all the way to, I mean, to, for example, in terms of command and control, multiple command and control centers that would allow for some graceful degradation of command and control if it did get into a fighting, a major scrap. All the way from HF, you know, adaptive HF, trouble scatter, and all the way to very, very short range, sort of stealthy sort of radio systems. And then, of course, they also appear to be looking quite a bit at, I'm not sure what the term of art these days, but basically that realm of near space. Not sure if there's a internationally agreed upon definition of where space begins, but generally it's about 100 kilometers in altitude between the atmosphere and the space. But that area between about 20 kilometers and 100 kilometers, what's called near space, is an area that China is looking at quite a bit in terms of deploying what we call like high altitude airships, basically types of air platforms that aren't necessarily, that would not had the same sort of propulsion systems that we would have in our conventional aircraft, but would fly higher than an SR-71 did back in the old days, you know, higher than, let's say, for example, 66 or 70,000 feet, but be able to fly slow and with having materials on it that makes it really hard to pick up, but having sensors and communications relay systems on these systems is something else they've been looking at. So I just want to throw that one out as an additional capability that they appear to be interested in. But in general, because they're going to be operating within from their shores with some sort of going out in these particular potential territorial disputes they would have around the periphery, they do have some advantages in terms of being able to disrupt command and control C4ISR systems of potential adversaries and be able to maintain the viability and integrity of some of their own systems.
Well, I'm gonna try and bring this back down, if not to Earth, at least to sea. But one of the other things I got out of the paper was that we need to have a common operating environment or common operating picture for our allies, and that among the other recommendations I took from the paper was that our allies and the United States need to be much more sea powerish in our approach to what the Chinese are up to. Is that a misreading? Is this a local issue with respect to the areas we discussed before, the South China Sea and the Northern Sea and the Taiwan area, or is this a global issue because of the Chinese sea lines of communication that they need to have to continue to develop? Now, there's a simple question for you. You can answer in the next 2 seconds.
Okay. Just put simply, I'm not sure if it's just a, you know, having a sort of a maritime, you know, a common operational picture that focused on the maritime domain. But certainly maritime domain awareness, or actually just in general multi-domain awareness is one way to put it. Because it's not just, of course, again, this is my Air Force coming out, but it's not just the it's just not the ocean or the sea, but undersea is very important, and on the surface is very important. And then, of course, in the air is important, being able to have a common operating air picture all the way to space. This is where it really can start, because there's a lot of opportunities to be able to pool the resources that various countries have in the region, whether it's Japan or South Korea, Taiwan being actually critical, and, of course, others in Southeast Asia. Being able to pool these particular resources is certainly something worthy looking at. Now, they may be scared off by the military aspects of it, but at a minimum, I mean, it's not just military, but it's also, for example, natural disaster relief, emergency management. Non-proliferation, for example, being able to track North Korean shipping from North Korea and then heading down to the South China Sea. And maritime domain awareness in general, or I should say multi-domain awareness, it's not necessarily military use. I mean, it has a lot of potential. And it's done particularly in a way where you focus more on disaster preparedness response as well as non-proliferation and just human trafficking and drug trafficking, these sorts of issues. It has a lot of potential, and something I think that could be investigated quite a bit more.
You know, part of the aspects of building our Asian alliance is, you could argue from at least a contributory point of view, the Australians are at the top of the tier group, but the Japanese are equally important, especially when you look at potential and proximity. And there's when you go through some of the vignettes, there's a discussion of not just using Japanese bases, but more Japanese recovery from their World War II mindset. For instance, I thought it was a really interesting point about the intermediate range nuclear forces and some options that Japan has down the road when it comes to ballistic missiles and integrating that into their military. But is it really realistic to expect Japan to put itself in risk of on the receiving end of military strikes from China to defend Taiwan, for instance, or to allow its territory to be used to defend Taiwan? And if so, I think that would represent a pretty big change and a mindset for a lot of our allies who've really become very dependent on the U.S. to do much of the, at least, if not the heavy lifting, at least the offensive capability. And if that represented a change in a mindset, what are some things that we can do to perhaps continue changing a mindset of some of our allies to really be full partners as opposed to auxiliary forces?
Well, as a preface, offense, defense, and the eye of the beholder kind of depends what side of the gun that you're looking at, just as a sort of a first issue. The Japanese traditionally have been quite averse to developing an ability to be able to do long range interdiction, to be able to strike capabilities, for example. They've had significant bias against having this sort of firepower delivery capability for quite a while. And so, point taken in terms of Japan being willing to be able to adopt some of these missions. But in terms of, defense of Japan, let's face it. If you're defending Japanese territory, for example, in somewhere in the future, just some really wild card scenario happens where Japan and China get into some sort of a scrape. In a full-fledged war, one cannot defend by just air defenses alone. And some strike capability is going to be needed for full defense. Of course, the question would be in terms of this particular role, it's thinking the unthinkable. But one, the U.S. or Japan, in terms of the alliance structure, would have to adopt this mission. I mean, to me, if that's going to, if there's an issue, for example, if there's a breakout of the INF Treaty, the INF Treaty completely goes away. For example, Russia has been talking about this for quite a while in terms of them feeling that their hands are bound. Why should they be bound by the INF Treaty? So if the INF Treaty goes away and suddenly there are opportunities for example, a resurrected Pershing II program or a resurrected ground launch cruise missile program. Of course, we already have submarine launched cruise missiles, but if there's a desire, for example, to have a land-based version to be able to, you know, not a prompt global strike capability, but a regional, you know, prompt regional strike capability, and deploying these on Japan, it's much better for the U.S. to do it than it would be for the Japanese. But this is something that would have to be discussed very, 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 very carefully with any partner in the region. Of course, on the Taiwan issue, that is a political bucket of worms in terms of the role that Japan will be expected to play in a Taiwan in a very unfortunate Taiwan contingency. I think there's some expectation that the treaty that sort of look at the area surrounding Japan, or I forgot the exact term, possibly would include Taiwan, but these would be issues that would have to be looked at, and within the political context of the time that something would happen. I don't think these issues are worked out ahead of time, and just simply too politically contentious to be able to work out ahead of time. I'm not sure if anybody knows what they would do if there were some sort of Chinese attempt to rely on force to be able to resolve some of the political differences with Taiwan.
Well, one of my questions that I was going to ask earlier about Taiwan is, as I kind of got from the paper and kind of my own thinking, is the goal of Taiwan to create sort of a porcupine, not necessarily that it can win the entire battle by itself, but such a nasty thing to chew on that you really don't want to mess with them? Or what exactly how should we be helping them approach that situation?
Well, the key thing is the idea is to be able to help Taiwan defend itself as a first priority. And the key thing is, the porcupine concept, of course, is one idea, but it's a general idea on, deterring the People's Republic of China. In other words, ensuring that when leadership, the political leadership in Zhongnanhai, together with the PLA leadership, make a calculation on whether or not to resort to use of force, that they do the cost-benefit calculus, and that they decide that that's just too much potential cost involved in using force. So deterrence is one way, and of course, then it gets down to defense, because deterrence through what? Generally, deterrence through denial. In other words, denying the PLA their ability to achieve their political objectives and to complicate the military strategy. And in general, what would the PLA course of action be? There's a number one of these things, and so one has to sort of figure out what course of action that you're talking about. Is it just an air pan, sort of a bombing to win sort of air campaign, or is it a blockade scenario? Is it a full scale balls to the wall sort of amphibious occupy Taiwan and then imposing your will upon the vanquished? But even if they occupy Taipei, it doesn't mean they have the whole island, and so all these things sort of would lead in, sort of would inform coming up with a strategy. And of course, the next part of that would be sort of the U.S. Some sort of ad hoc coalition with the United States in terms of intervening to be able to enforce a halt in military operations. And so, you know, from Taiwan's perspective, I mean, some of the things should be obvious. Let's say, for example, you know, in order to be able to counter each and every one of these scenarios, short range, you know, some of the common ones, short range air defenses, smaller, fast ships on the ocean, and to me, a big one would be, of course, submarines, diesel electric submarines, perhaps some smaller ships. So these are just some capabilities to me that would really that should be obvious.
I wanted to throw your way a question I asked our guest last week, because it's kind of related, and that's, we've been engaged in the wars we've been engaged in for the last 10 years and have really been, in many respects, borescoped on Southwest Asia. And you combine that with the fact that China has changed so much in the last decade, especially, you know, two decades, that there are, in the general public, some long-held assumptions about China. What are some of those assumptions about China that many people have that really are no longer valid, and what do they really need to think of when somebody says China?
Well, in terms of one of the things to think about is it's not, a lot of people assume that they know where China wants to go in the future. In other words, that they automatically look at China as a potential threat. Knows they have, and actually it's never made quite clear what they think where China wants to be by the year 2050, for example, or 2049. For example, you know, in terms of do they really want to completely run the United States out of the region in terms of its alliance structures? And so that's what, and that's just a question. I don't really know the answer, but I wouldn't automate. Of course, the territorial disputes and sovereignty disputes are obvious. But that's sort of the first question, is sort of looking at where China's going in the future, because they may not know themselves. However, things that they're doing today sort of create a momentum that could take off on a life of their own, due to, for example, the PLA pushing for more pieces of the overall central government budget, or even within that, Second Artillery, Air Force, or Navy pushing for their own pieces. And that could take on a dynamic on its own. Another is this automatic assumption of China's rise. My understanding is the Chinese themselves, I mean, use that word rise, it's peaceful development, the term that they use. Because, yes, they could rise in terms of their economic power, and they are certainly certainly demonstrating significant economic capabilities. But when you get down, you scratch underneath the surface, are they really that scary in terms of economy, particularly when you look at who's investing? For example, Taiwan is a major investor in China. It's not really the Chinese. When you go into Best Buy and you buy a cell phone or a computer, it may say made in China, but it's actually made in a Taiwanese factory in China. But these would be a couple of the things that I would ask. But yes, they're getting stronger militarily. One should really look at different scenarios and not be afraid about standing up for trying to discourage increased Chinese reliance on force to be able to solve some of the problems. And that's where you need to have a strong United States. And a strong system of alliances to be able to, at a minimum at least, to be able to provide a hedge until the direction that China's going becomes more clear.
Well, as you as described in the piece and many other places, I mean, I'm sometimes amazed at a country that has a reputation for its subtlety occasionally just acts like the biggest bully on the block. I mean, some of these activities in the South China Sea, with respect to the Spratlys and some of the other islands out there, some of these other things they're doing with Japan, they seem so ham-handed sometimes. Is that just the nature or is that more subtle than I think it is? What do you see in that sort of situation?
Well, I guess one way to look at it would be to ask, you know, always track down the sources, figure out who went, you know, exactly who said what, to be able to sort of do content analysis on media to make sure that it's not sort of media blowing stuff up. But also look at other things that are going around the periphery. In other words, there's a lot of struggles that go inside China, inside Beijing, in terms of different factions. So sometimes one particular faction may have to sort of blow up an issue to be able to maybe divert domestic attention from their own problems they have inside. Taiwan is something that's forgotten quite a bit. Sometimes I wonder if China sometimes create problems intentionally in the South China Sea just to be able to at least create the perception that everything is fine on the Taiwan front, when actually China has not at all. They're not rattling their saber on Taiwan as they are in the South China Sea. But one sometimes has to ask the question, is this somewhat of a diversion? And the same thing, of course, with Japan. But that sometimes does, it's certainly worth asking, it's a good question asking why they do the way that they do things sometimes, and it doesn't really appear to be necessary or even urgent at that particular time putting yourself in their position. So I don't have the exact answer to that, but I could formulate some questions.
Well, on that note, Mark, we've got a tail end of a very fast hour. If you could just take a minute to tell us what direction the 2049 Institute is going on, and if they wanted to read more what you or the Institute has to offer, where would be a good place for them to go?
Well, they can go on what we produce is published on our website, www.project2049, that's one word, project2049.net, and what we publish goes on that. And in terms of myself, I'm going to continue to sort of look at the directions on Chinese missile modernization, perhaps looking a bit at the nuclear capabilities, of course, continue to focus on the issue, you know, cross-strait military and political issues in Taiwan, and just in general, continue to sort of try to fill in some blocks and sort of fill in some gaps on understanding about the future direction of the United States in the Asia-Pacific region.
Perfect. And thanks a lot again, Mark, for coming on this Sunday for an hour. I really appreciate it. It's been a great conversation.
Yeah, thank
you, Mark. I appreciate you inviting me. It's been fun.
And thanks, everybody, for joining us live. And for those that got us later on the archive, please join us again next time for MidRats. And until then, have a great Navy Day.
Goddamn.